They gained Ronnie's private room, where a group of their own sort had collected. None were cowardly, all nervy, for queer reports kept coming in. The sweepers had just struck, and half the commodes of Chandrapur remained desolate in consequence. Only half, and sweepers from the district, who felt less strongly about the innocence of Dr. Aziz, would arrive in the afternoon and break the strike. But why should the grotesque incident occur? And a number of Mohammedan ladies had sworn to take no food until the prisoner was acquitted. Their death would make little difference, indeed. Being invisible, they seemed dead already. Nevertheless, it was disquieting. A new spirit seemed abroad, a rearrangement which no one in the stern little band of whites could explain. There was a tendency to see Fielding at the back of it. The idea that he was weak and cranky had been dropped. They abused Fielding vigorously. He had been seen driving up with the two consuls, Amrit Rao and Mahmud Ali. He encouraged the Boy Scout movement for seditious reasons. He received letters with foreign stamps on them and was probably a Japanese spy. This morning's verdict would break the renegade, but he had done his country and the empire incalculable disservice. There was silence. Then, dreamily but with deep feeling, the voice said,
"Cyril, I have had an idea which will satisfy your tender mind. I shall consult Mrs. Moore."
Opening his eyes and beholding thousands of stars, he could not reply. They silenced him.
"Her opinion will solve everything. I can trust her so absolutely. If she advises me to pardon this girl, I shall do so. She will counsel me nothing against my real and true honour, as you might."
"Let us discuss that tomorrow morning."
"Is it not strange? I keep on forgetting she has left India. During the shouting of her name in court, I fancied she was present. I had shut my eyes. I confused myself on purpose to deaden the pain. Now, this very instant, I forgot again. I shall be obliged to write. She is now far away, well on her way towards Ralph and Stella."
"To whom?"
"To those other children."
"I have not heard of other children."
"Just as I have two boys and a girl, so has Mrs. Moore. She told me in the mosque."
"I knew her so slightly."
"I have seen her but three times, but I know she is an Oriental."
"You are so fantastic. Miss Quested, you won't treat her generously, while over Mrs. Moore there is this elaborate chivalry. Miss Quested, anyhow, behaved decently this morning, whereas the old lady never did anything for you at all, and it's pure conjecture that she would have come forward in your favour. It only rests on servants' gossip. Your emotions never seem in proportion to their objects, Aziz."
"Is emotion a sack of potatoes, so much the pound, to be measured out? Am I a machine? I shall be told I can use up my emotions by using them next."
"I should have thought you could. It sounds common sense. You can't eat your cake and have it, even in the world of the spirit."
"If you are right, there is no point in any friendship. It all comes down to give and take, or give and return, which is disgusting, and we had better all leap over this parapet and kill ourselves. Is anything wrong with you this evening that you grow so materialistic?"
"Your unfairness is worse than my materialism."
"I see. Anything further to complain of?"
He was good-tempered and affectionate, but a little formidable. Imprisonment had made channels for his character, which would never fluctuate as widely now as in the past.
"Because it is far better you put all your difficulties before me, if we are to be friends forever. You do not like Mrs. Moore, and are annoyed because I do. However, you will like her in time."
When a person really dead is supposed to be alive, an unhealthiness infects the conversation. Fielding could not stand the tension any longer and blurted out,
"I'm sorry to say, Mrs. Moore's dead."
But Hamidullah, who had been listening to all their talk and did not want the festive evening spoilt, cried from the adjoining bed,
"Aziz, he is trying to pull your leg. Don't believe him, the villain."
"I do not believe him," said Aziz.
He was inured to practical jokes, even of this type.
End of Disc 7. Please continue with the next disc.
Part 3. Temple. Chapter 33. Some hundreds of miles westward of the Marabar Hills, and 2 years later in time, Professor Narayan Godbole stands in the presence of God. God is not born yet. That will occur at midnight. But he has also been born centuries ago, nor can he ever be born, because he is the Lord of the universe who transcends human processes. He is, was not, is not, was. He and Professor Godbole stood at opposite ends of the same strip of carpet. Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram. This corridor in the palace at Mao opened through other corridors into a courtyard. It was of beautiful hard white stucco, but its pillars and vaulting could scarcely be seen behind coloured rags, iridescent balls, chandeliers of opaque pink glass, and murky photographs framed crookedly. At the end was the small but famous shrine of the dynastic cult, and the god to be born was largely a silver image the size of a teaspoon. Hindus sat on either side of the carpet where they could find room, or overflowed into the adjoining corridors and the courtyard. Hindus, Hindus only, mild-featured men, mostly villagers, for whom anything outside their villages passed in a dream. They were the toiling riot, whom some call the real India. Mixed with them sat a few tradesmen out of the little town, officials, courtiers, scions of the ruling house. Schoolboys kept inefficient order. The assembly was in a tender, happy state unknown to an English crowd. It seethed like a beneficent potion. When the villagers broke cordon for a glimpse of the silver image, a most beautiful and radiant expression came into their faces, a beauty in which there was nothing personal, for it caused them all to resemble one another during the moment of its indwelling, and only when it was withdrawn did they revert to individual clods. And so with the music. Music there was, but from so many sources that the sum total was untrammelled. The braying, banging, crooning melted into a single mass, which trailed round the palace before joining the thunder. Rain fell at intervals throughout the night.
It is useless discussing Hindus with me. Living with them teaches me no more. When I think I annoy them, I do not. When I think I don't annoy them, I do. Perhaps they will sack me for tumbling onto their doll's house. On the other hand, perhaps they will double my salary. Time will prove. Why so curious about them?
It's difficult to explain. I never really understood or liked them, except an occasional scrap of Godbole. Does the old fellow still say, come, come? Oh, presumably.
Fielding sighed, opened his lips, shut them, then said with a little laugh,
I can't explain because it isn't in words at all, but why do my wife and her brother like Hinduism, though they take no interest in its forms? They won't talk to me about this. They know I think a certain side of their lives is a mistake and are shy. That's why I wish you would talk to them, for at all events, you're Oriental.
Aziz refused to reply. He didn't want to meet Stella and Ralph again, knew they didn't want to meet him, was incurious about their secrets, and felt good old Cyril to be a bit clumsy. Something, not a sight, but a sound, flitted past him and caused him to reread his letter to Miss Quested. Hadn't he wanted to say something else to her? Taking out his pen, he added,
For my own part, I shall henceforth connect you with the name that is very sacred in my mind, namely, Mrs. Moore.
When he had finished, the mirror of the scenery was shattered, the meadow disintegrated into butterflies. A poem about Mecca, the Kaaba of union, the thorn bushes where pilgrims die before they have seen the friend. They flitted next. He thought of his wife, and then the whole semi-mystic, semi-sensuous overturn, so characteristic of his spiritual life, came to end like a landslip, and rested in its due place, and he found himself riding in the jungle with his dear Cyril.
Oh, shut up, he said. Don't spoil our last hour with foolish questions. Leave Krishna alone and talk about something sensible.
They did. All the way back to Mao, they wrangled about politics. Each had hardened since Chandrapur, and a good knockabout proved enjoyable. They trusted each other, although they were going to part, perhaps because they were going to part. Fielding had no further use for politeness, he said, meaning that the British Empire really can't be abolished because it's rude. Aziz retorted, "Very well, and we have no use for you," and glared at him with abstract hate. Fielding said, "Away from us, Indians go to seed at once. Look at the King Emperor High School. Look at you forgetting your medicine and going back to charms. Look at your poems. Jolly good poems. I'm getting published Bombay side." "Yes, and what do they say? Free our women and India will be free." "Try it, my lad. Free your own lady in the first place, and see who'll wash Ahmed, Karim and Jamila's faces. A nice situation." Aziz grew more excited. He rose in his stirrups and pulled at his horse's head in the hope it would rear. Then he should feel in a battle. He cried, "Clear out, all you Turtons and Burtons! We wanted to know you 10 years back. Now it's too late. If we see you and sit on your committees, it's for political reasons. Don't you make any mistake." His horse did rear. "Clear out! Clear out, I say!"
"Excuse the question, but if this is the case, how is England justified in holding India?"
There they were, politics again.
"It's a question I can't get my mind onto," he replied. "I'm out here personally because I needed a job. I cannot tell you why England is here, or whether she ought to be here. It's beyond me."
"Well-qualified Indians also need jobs in the educational."
"I guess they do. I got in first," said Fielding, smiling.
"Then, excuse me again, is it fair an Englishman should occupy one when Indians are available? Of course, I mean nothing personally. Personally, we are delighted you should be here, and we benefit greatly by this frank talk."
There is only one answer to a conversation of this type. England holds India for her good. Yet Fielding was disinclined to give it. The zeal for honesty had eaten him up. He said,
"I'm delighted to be here too. That's my answer. There's my only excuse. I can't tell you anything about fairness. It mayn't have been fair I should have been born. I take up some other fellow's air, don't I, whenever I breathe. Still, I'm glad it's happened, and I'm glad I'm out here. However big a budmash one is, if one's happy in consequence, that's some justification."
The Indians were bewildered. The line of thought was not alien to them, but the words were too definite and bleak. Unless a sentence paid a few compliments to justice and morality in passing, its grammar wounded their ears and paralyzed their minds. What they said and what they felt were, except in the case of affection, seldom the same. They had numerous mental conventions, and when they were flouted, they found it very difficult to function. Hamidullah bore up best.
"And those Englishmen who are not delighted to be in India, have they no excuse?" he asked.
"None. Chuck 'em out."
"It may be difficult to separate them from the rest," he laughed.
"Worse than difficult. Wrong," said Mr. Ramchand. "No Indian gentleman approves chucking out as a proper thing. Here we differ from those other nations. We are so spiritual."
"Oh, that is true. How true?" said the police inspector. "Is it true, Mr. Huck? I don't consider us spiritual. We can't coordinate. We can't coordinate. It only comes to that. We can't keep engagements. We can't catch trains. What more than this is the so-called spirituality of India? You and I ought to be at the Committee of Notables. We are not. Our friend Dr. Lal ought to be with his patients. He isn't. So we go on. And so we shall continue to go, I think, until the end of time."
"It is not the end of time. It is scarcely 10:30. Ha ha!" cried Dr. Panalal, who was again in confident mood. "Gentlemen, if I may be allowed to say a few words, what an interesting talk. Also, thankfulness and gratitude to Mr. Fielding in the first place teaches our sons and gives them all the great benefits of his experience and judgment. Dr. Lal? Dr. Aziz? You sit on my leg. I beg pardon, but some might say your leg kicks."
"Come along,"
We tire the invalid in either case, said Fielding. And they filed out. 4 Mohammedans, 2 Hindus, and the Englishman. They stood on the veranda while their conveyances were summoned out of various patches of shade.
Aziz has a high opinion of you. He only did not speak because of his illness.
I quite understand, said Fielding, who was rather disappointed with this call. The club comment, making himself cheap as usual, passed through his mind. He couldn't even get his horse brought up. He had liked Aziz so much at their first meeting, and had hoped for developments.
End of Disc 3. Please continue with the next disc.
I always enjoy conversing about the Mughals. It is the chief pleasure I know. You see, those first 6 emperors were all most wonderful men, and as soon as one of them is mentioned, no matter which, I forget everything else in the world except the other 5. You could not find 6 such kings in all the countries of the earth. Not, I mean, coming one after the other, father, son.
Tell us something about Akbar.
Ah, you have heard the name of Akbar. Good. Hamidullah, whom you shall meet, will tell you that Akbar is the greatest of all. I say, yes, Akbar is very wonderful, but half a Hindu. He was not a true Muslim, which makes Hamidullah cry, no more was Babur, he drank wine. But Babur always repented afterwards, which makes the entire difference. And Akbar never repented of the new religion he invented instead of the Holy Quran.
But wasn't Akbar's new religion very fine? It was to embrace the whole of India.
Misquested, fine, but foolish. You keep your religion, I mine. That is the best. Nothing embraces the whole of India. Nothing, nothing. And that was Akbar's mistake.
Oh, do you feel that, Dr. Aziz? She said thoughtfully. I hope you're not right. There will have to be something universal in this country. I don't say religion, for I'm not religious. But something, or how else are barriers to be broken down?
She was only recommending the universal brotherhood he sometimes dreamt of. But as soon as it was put into prose, it became untrue.
Take my own case, she continued.
It was indeed her own case that had animated her.
I don't know whether you happen to have heard, but I'm going to marry Mr. Heslop.
On which my heartiest congratulations.
Mrs. Moore, may I put our difficulty to Dr. Aziz? I mean, our Anglo-Indian one.
It is your difficulty and not mine, my dear.
Ah, that's true. Well, by marrying Mr. Heslop, I shall become what is known as an Anglo-Indian.
He held up his hand in protest.
Impossible. Take back such a terrible remark.
But I shall. It's inevitable. I can't avoid the label. What I do hope to avoid is the mentality. Women like...
She stopped, not quite liking to mention names. She would boldly have said Mrs. Turton and Mrs. Callender a fortnight ago.
Some women are so... well, ungenerous and snobby about Indians, and I should feel too ashamed for words if I turned like them. But, and here's my difficulty, there's nothing special about me, nothing specially good or strong, which will help me to resist my environment and avoid becoming like them. I've most lamentable defects. That's why I want Akbar's universal religion, or the equivalent, to keep me decent and sensible. Do you see what I mean?
Her remarks pleased him, but his mind shut up tight because she had alluded to her marriage. He was not going to be mixed up in that side of things.
You are certain to be happy with any relative of Mrs. Moore's, he said with a formal bow.
Oh, my happiness, that's quite another problem. I want to consult you about this Anglo-Indian difficulty. Can you give me any advice?
You are absolutely unlike the others, I assure you. You will never be rude to my people.
I'm told we all get rude after a year.
Then you are told a lie, he flashed, for she had spoken the truth, and it touched him on the raw.
It was itself an insult in these particular circumstances. He recovered himself at once and laughed, but her error broke up their conversation, their civilization it had almost been, which scattered like the petals of a desert flower, and left them in the middle of the hills.
Come along, he said.
holding out a hand to each. They got up a little reluctantly and addressed themselves to sightseeing.
I can think of nothing but our poor Aziz. Have you grasped that at the present moment he is in prison?
Oh, yes. Oh, no, I do not expect an answer to my question now. I only meant that when you are at leisure, you might think the matter over and suggest two or three alternative titles for schools. I had thought of the Mr. Fielding High School, but feeling that, the King Emperor George V.
God, Bole.
The old fellow put his hands together and looked sly and charming. Is Aziz innocent or guilty?
That is for the court to decide. The verdict will be in strict accordance with the evidence, I make no doubt.
Yes, yes, but your personal opinion. Here's a man we both like, generally esteemed. He lives here quietly doing his work. Well, what's one to make of it? Would he or would he not do such a thing?
Ah, that is rather a different question from your previous one, and also more difficult. I mean, difficult in our philosophy. Dr. Aziz is a most worthy young man. I have a great regard for him. But I think you are asking me whether the individual can commit good actions or evil actions, and that is rather difficult for us.
He spoke without emotion and in short, tripping syllables.
I ask you, did he do it or not? Is that plain? I know he didn't, and from that I start. I mean to get at the true explanation in a couple of days. My last notion is that it's the guide who went round with them. Malice on Miss Quested's part, it couldn't be that, though Hamidullah thinks so. She has certainly had some appalling experience. But you tell me, oh no, because good and evil are the same.
No, not exactly, please, according to our philosophy. Because nothing can be performed in isolation. All perform a good action when one is performed, and when an evil action is performed, all perform it. To illustrate my meaning, let me take the case in point as an example. I am informed that an evil action was performed in the Marabar Hills, and that a highly esteemed English lady is now seriously ill in consequence. My answer to that is this. That action was performed by Dr. Aziz.
He stopped and sucked in his thin cheeks.
It was performed by the guide.
He stopped again.
It was performed by you.
Now he had an air of daring and of coyness.
It was performed by me.
He looked shyly down the sleeve of his own coat.
And by my students. It was even performed by the lady herself. When evil occurs, it expresses the whole of the universe. Similarly, when good occurs.
And similarly, when suffering occurs, and so on and so forth, and everything is anything and nothing something,
he muttered in his irritation, for he needed the solid ground. While they denounced him, Miss Quested lay back with her hands on the arms of her chair and her eyes closed, reserving her strength. They noticed her after a time and felt ashamed of making so much noise.
"Can we do nothing for you?" Miss Derrick said. "I don't think so, Nancy, and I seem able to do nothing for myself." "But you're strictly forbidden to talk like that. You're wonderful."
"Yes, indeed,"
came the reverent chorus.
"My old dass is all right," said Ronnie, starting a new subject in low tones.
"Not one of them's all right,"
contradicted Major Callender.
"Dass is, really." "You mean he's more frightened of acquitting than convicting, because if he acquits, he'll lose his job," said Leslie with a clever little laugh.
Ronnie did mean that, but he cherished illusions about his own subordinates, following the finer traditions of his service here, and he liked to maintain that his old dass really did possess moral courage of the public school brand. He pointed out that from one point of view, it was good that an Indian was taking the case. Conviction was inevitable, so better let an Indian pronounce it. There would be less fuss in the long run. Interested in the argument, he let Adela become dim in his mind.
"In fact, you disapprove of the appeal I forwarded to Lady Mellenbeck,"
said Mrs. Turton with considerable heat.
Pray don't apologise, Mr. Heslop. I am accustomed to being in the wrong.
I didn't mean that.
All right. I said don't apologise.
Those swine are always on the lookout for a grievance, said Leslie to propitiate her.
Swine? I should think so,
the Major echoed.
And what's more, I'll tell you what. What's happened is a damn good thing, really, barring, of course, its application to present company. It'll make them squeal, and it's time they did squeal. I've put the fear of God into them at the hospital anyhow. You should see the grandson of our so-called leading loyalist.
He tittered brutally as he described poor Nureddin's present appearance.
His beauty's gone. 5 upper teeth, 2 lower, and a nostril. Old Panalal brought him the looking-glass yesterday, and he blubbered. I laughed, I tell you, and so would you. That used to be one of these buck niggers, I thought. Now he's all septic. Damn him, blast his soul. I believe he was unspeakably immoral.
He subsided, nudged in the ribs, but added,
I wish I'd had the cutting up of my late assistant, too. Nothing's too bad for these people.
At last, some sense is being talked, Mrs. Turton cried, much to her husband's discomfort.
That's what I say. I say there's not such a thing as cruelty after a thing like this.
Exactly. And remember it afterwards, you men. You're weak, weak, weak. Why, they ought to crawl from here to the caves on their hands and knees whenever an Englishwoman's in sight. They oughtn't to be spoken to. They ought to be spat at. They ought to be ground into the dust. We've been far too kind with our bridge parties and the rest.
She paused, profiting by her wrath. The heat had invaded her. She subsided into a lemon squash and continued between the sips to murmur, Weak! Weak! And the process was repeated. The issues Miss Quested had raised were so much more important than she was herself that people inevitably forgot her. It was the turn of Professor Godbole's choir. As Minister of Education, he gained this special honour. When the previous group of singers dispersed into the crowd, he pressed forward from the back, already in full voice, that the chain of sacred sounds might be uninterrupted. He was barefoot and in white. He wore a pale blue turban. His gold pince-nez had caught in a jasmine garland and lay sideways down his nose. He and 6 colleagues who supported him clashed their cymbals, hit small drums, droned upon a portable harmonium, and sang, Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram, Tukaram, thou art my father and mother and everybody. Tukaram, Tukaram. They sang not even to the god who confronted them, but to a saint. They did not one thing which the non-Hindu would feel dramatically correct. This approaching triumph of India was a muddle, as we call it, a frustration of reason and form. Where was the god himself, in whose honour the congregation had gathered? Indistinguishable in the jumble of his own altar, huddled out of sight amid images of inferior descent, smothered under rose leaves, overhung by oleographs, outblazed by golden tablets representing the Raja's ancestors, and entirely obscured, when the wind blew, by the tattered foliage of a banana. Hundreds of electric lights had been lit in his honour, worked by an engine whose thumps destroyed the rhythm of the hymn. Yet his face could not be seen. Hundreds of his silver dishes were piled around him with the minimum of effect. The inscriptions which the poets of the state had composed were hung where they could not be read, or had twitched their drawing pins out of the stucco, and one of them, composed in English to indicate his universality, consisted, by an unfortunate slip of the draughtsman, of the words, God si love. God si love. Is this the final message of India? Tukaram, Tukaram, continued the choir, reinforced by a squabble behind the purdha curtain, where 2 mothers tried to push their children at the same moment to the front. A little girl's leg shot out like an eel. In the courtyard, drenched by the rain,
the small Europeanized band stumbled off into a waltz. Nights of Gladness they were playing. The singers were not perturbed by this rival. They lived beyond competition.
Why are we put to so much suffering? We used to blame you. Now we blame ourselves. We grow wiser. Until England is in difficulties, we keep silent. But in the next European war, aha, aha, then is our time.
He paused, and the scenery, though it smiled, fell like a gravestone on any human hope. They cantered past a temple to Hanuman. God so loved the world that he took monkey's flesh upon him, and passed a Saivite temple which invited to lust, but under the semblance of eternity, its obscenities bearing no relation to those of our flesh and blood. They splashed through butterflies and frogs. Great trees with leaves like plates rose among the brushwood. The divisions of daily life were returning. The shrine had almost shut.
"Who do you want instead of the English? The Japanese?" jeered Fielding, drawing rein. "No, the Afghans, my own ancestors." "Oh, your Hindu friends will like that, won't they?" "It will be arranged, a conference of Oriental statesmen." "It will indeed be arranged. Old story of we will rob every man and rape every woman from Peshawar to Calcutta, I suppose, which you get some nobody to repeat and then quote every week in the Pioneer in order to frighten us into retaining you. We know."
Still, he couldn't quite fit in Afghans at Mao, and finding he was in a corner, made his horse rear again until he remembered that he had, or ought to have, a motherland. Then he shouted, "India shall be a nation! No foreigners of any sort, Hindu and Muslim and Sikh and all shall be one. Hurrah! Hurrah for India! Hurrah! Hurrah!" India a nation. What an apotheosis. Last comer to the drab 19th century sisterhood. Waddling in at this hour of the world to take her seat. She whose only peer was the Holy Roman Empire, she shall rank with Guatemala and Belgium, perhaps. Fielding mocked again. And Aziz, in an awful rage, danced this way and that, not knowing what to do, and cried, "Down with the English, anyhow! That's certain! Clear out, you fellows, double quick, I say! We may hate one another, but we hate you most. If I don't make you go, Ahmed will, Karim will. If it's 50 or 500 years, we shall get rid of you. Yes, we shall drive every blasted Englishman into the sea. And then..." He rode against him furiously. "And then," he concluded, half kissing him, "you and I shall be friends."
"Why can't we be friends now?" said the other, holding him affectionately. "It's what I want. It's what you want."
But the horses didn't want it. They swerved apart. The earth didn't want it, sending up rocks through which riders must pass single file. The temples, the tank, the jail, the palace, the birds, the carrion, the guest house that came into view as they issued from the gap and saw Mao beneath. They didn't want it. They said in their 100 voices, "No, not yet." And the sky said, "No, not there." The first cave was tolerably convenient. They skirted the puddle of water and then climbed up over some unattractive stones, the sun crashing on their backs. Bending their heads, they disappeared one by one into the interior of the hills. The small black hole gaped where their varied forms and colours had momentarily functioned. They were sucked in like water down a drain. Bland and bald rose the precipices, bland and glutinous the sky that connected the precipices. Solid and white, a Brahmani kite flapped between the rocks with a clumsiness that seemed intentional. Before man with his itch for the seemly had been born, the planet must have looked thus. The kite flapped away. Before birds, perhaps. And then the hole belched and humanity returned. A Marabar cave had been horrid as far as Mrs. Moore was concerned, for she had nearly fainted in it, and had some difficulty in preventing herself from saying so as soon as she got into the air again. It was natural enough. She had always suffered from faintness, and the cave had become too full, because all their retinue followed them. Crammed with villagers and servants, the circular chamber began to smell. She lost Aziz and Adela in the dark, didn't know who touched her, couldn't breathe, and some vile naked thing struck her face and settled on her mouth like a pad. She tried to regain the entrance tunnel, but an influx of villagers swept her back. She hit her head. For an instant she went mad, hitting and gasping like a fanatic. For not only did the crush and stench alarm her, there was also a terrifying echo. Professor Godbole had never mentioned an echo. It never impressed him, perhaps. There are some exquisite echoes in India. There is the whisper around the dome at Bijapur. There are the long, solid sentences that voyage through the air at Mandu and return unbroken to their creator. The echo in a Marabar cave is not like these. It is entirely devoid of distinction. Whatever is said, the same monotonous noise replies and quivers up and down the walls until it is absorbed into the roof. Boom is the sound as far as the human alphabet can express it, or boom, or oo-boom. Utterly dull. Hope, politeness, the blowing of a nose, the squeak of a boot, all produce boom. Even the striking of a match starts a little worm coiling, which is too small to complete a circle, but is eternally watchful. And if several people talk at once, an overlapping howling noise begins. Echoes generate echoes, and the cave is stuffed with a snake composed of small snakes, which writhe independently. After Mrs. Moore, all the others poured out. She had given the signal for the reflux. Aziz and Adela both emerged smiling, and she did not want him to think his treat was a failure, so smiled too. As each person emerged, she looked for a villain, but none was there, and she realized that she had been among the mildest individuals whose only desire was to honor her, and that the naked pad was a poor little baby astride its mother's hip. Nothing evil had been in the cave, but she had not enjoyed herself. No, she had not enjoyed herself, and she decided not to visit a second one.
"Did you see the reflection of his match? Rather pretty," asked Adela. "I forget. But he says this isn't a good cave. The best are on the Kawadol. I don't think I shall go on to there. I dislike climbing." "Very well. Let's sit down again in the shade until breakfast's ready." "Ah, but that'll disappoint him so. He has taken such trouble. You should go on. You don't mind." "Perhaps I ought to," said the girl, indifferent to what she did, but desirous of being amiable.
End of disc 4. Please continue with the next disc.
"Excuse me, you are now again changing the basis of our discussion. We were discussing good and evil. Suffering is merely a matter for the individual. If a young lady has sunstroke, that is a matter of no significance to the universe. Oh, no, not at all. Oh, no, not the least. It is an isolated matter. It only concerns herself. If she thought her head did not ache, she would not be ill, and that would end it. But it is far otherwise in the case of good and evil. They are not what we think them. They are what they are. And each of us has contributed to both. You're preaching that evil and good are the same." "Oh, no, excuse me once again. Good and evil are different, as their names imply. But, in my own humble opinion, they are both of them aspects of my Lord. He is present in the one, absent in the other. And the difference between presence and absence is great as my feeble mind can grasp. Yet, absence implies presence. Absence is not non-existence, and we are therefore entitled to repeat, 'Come, come, come, come.'"
And in the same breath, as if to cancel any beauty his words might have contained, he added,
"But did you have time to visit any of the interesting Marabar antiquities?"
Fielding was silent, trying to meditate and rest his brain.
Did you not even see the tank by the usual camping ground?
He nagged. Yes, yes, he answered distractedly, wandering over half a dozen things at once.
That is good. Then you saw the tank of the dagger.
And he related a legend which might have been acceptable if he had told it at the tea party a fortnight ago. It concerned a Hindu Raja who had slain his own sister's son, and the dagger with which he performed the deed remained clamped to his hand until in the course of years he came to the Malabar Hills where he was thirsty and wanted to drink, but saw a thirsty cow and ordered the water to be offered to her first, which, when done, dagger fell from his hand, and to commemorate miracle, he built tank. Professor Godbole's conversations frequently culminated in a cow. Fielding received this one in gloomy silence. In the afternoon, he obtained a permit and saw Aziz, but found him unapproachable through misery.
"You deserted me," was the only coherent remark.
He went away to write his letter to Miss Quested. Even if it reached her, it would do no good, and probably the McBrides would withhold it. Miss Quested did pull him up short. She was such a dry, sensible girl, and quite without malice, the last person in Chandrapur wrongfully to accuse an Indian. Presently, the case was called. Their chairs preceded them into the court, for it was important that they should look dignified. And when the chaprasis had made all ready, they filed into the ramshackly room with a condescending air, as if it was a booth at a fair. The collector made a small official joke as he sat down, at which his entourage smiled, and the Indians, who could not hear what he said, felt that some new cruelty was afoot, otherwise the Sahibs would not chuckle. The court was crowded, and of course very hot, and the first person Adela noticed in it was the humblest of all who were present, a person who had no bearing officially upon the trial, the man who pulled the panka. Almost naked and splendidly formed, he sat on a raised platform near the back in the middle of the central gangway, and he caught her attention as she came in, and he seemed to control the proceedings. He had the strength and beauty that sometimes come to flower in Indians of low birth. When that strange race nears the dust and is condemned as untouchable, then nature remembers the physical perfection that she accomplished elsewhere and throws out a god, not many, but one here and there, to prove to society how little its categories impress her. This man would have been notable anywhere. Among the thin-hammed, flat-chested mediocrities of Chandrapur, he stood out as divine, yet he was of the city. Its garbage had nourished him. He would end on its rubbish heaps. Pulling the rope towards him, relaxing it rhythmically, sending swirls of air over others, receiving none himself, he seemed, apart from human destinies, a male fate, a winnower of souls. Opposite him, also on a platform, sat the little assistant magistrate, cultivated, self-conscious, and conscientious. The punkahwala was none of these things. He scarcely knew that he existed, and did not understand why the court was fuller than usual. Indeed, he did not know that it was fuller than usual, didn't even know he worked a fan, though he thought he pulled a rope. Something in his aloofness impressed the girl from middle-class England, and rebuked the narrowness of her sufferings. In virtue of what had she collected this roomful of people together? Her particular brand of opinions, and the suburban Jehovah who sanctified them, by what right did they claim so much importance in the world and assume the title of civilization? Mrs. Moore? She looked round, but Mrs. Moore was far away on the sea. It was the kind of question they might have discussed on the voyage out, before the old lady had turned disagreeable and queer.
End of Disc 6. Please continue with the next disc.
It was long before the tiny fragment of Professor Godbole that attended to outside things decided that his pince-nez was in trouble, and that until it was adjusted he could not choose a new hymn. He laid down one cymbal, with the other he clashed the air, with his free hand he fumbled at the flowers round his neck. A colleague assisted him. Singing into one another's grey moustaches, they disentangled the chain from the tinsel into which it had sunk. Godberlet consulted the music book, said a word to the drummer who broke rhythm, made a thick little blur of sound, and produced a new rhythm. This was more exciting, the inner images it evoked more definite, and the singer's expressions became fatuous and languid. They loved all men, the whole universe, and scraps of their past, tiny splinters of detail, emerged for a moment to melt into the universal warmth. Thus Godbole, though she was not important to him, remembered an old woman he had met in Chandrapur days. Chance brought her into his mind while it was in this heated state. He did not select her. She happened to occur among the throng of soliciting images, a tiny splinter, and he impelled her by his spiritual force to that place where completeness can be found. Completeness, not reconstruction. His senses grew thinner. He remembered a wasp seen he forgot where, perhaps on a stone. He loved the wasp equally. He impelled it likewise. He was imitating God. And the stone where the wasp clung, could he? No, he had been wrong to attempt the stone. Logic and conscious effort had seduced. He came back to the strip of red carpet and discovered that he was dancing upon it. Up and down, a third of the way to the altar and back again, clashing his cymbals, his little legs twinkling, his companions dancing with him and each other. Noise, noise, the Europeanized band louder, incense on the altar, sweat, the blaze of lights, wind in the bananas, noise, thunder. 11:50 by his wristwatch, seen as he threw up his hands and detached the tiny reverberation that was his soul. Louder shouts in the crowd. He danced on. The boys and men who were squatting in the aisles were lifted forcibly and dropped without changing their shapes into the laps of their neighbours. Down the path thus cleared advanced a litter. It was the aged ruler of the state, brought, against the advice of his physicians, to witness the birth ceremony. No one greeted the Raja, nor did he wish it. This was no moment for human glory. Nor could the litter be set down, lest it defiled the temple by becoming a throne. He was lifted out of it while its feet remained in air and deposited on the carpet close to the altar. His immense beard was straightened, his legs tucked under him, a paper containing red powder was placed in his hand. There he sat, leaning against a pillar, exhausted with illness, his eyes magnified by many unshed tears. He had not to wait long.
Production copyright 1994, Chivers Audiobooks. All rights reserved. Licensed from Chivers Audiobooks by the Audio Partners Publishing Corporation. The Audio Partners Publishing Corporation is pleased to be the publisher of E.M. Forster's A Room with a View, read by Joanna David. We also publish many other classic works, including Kim, Jane Eyre, Sense and Sensibility, and The Age of Innocence. For a free audio editions catalog offering thousands of audiobooks on cassette and compact disc from all major publishers, call toll-free 1-800-231-4261. Visit our website at www.audioeditions.com.
Chapter 20. Although Miss Quested had not made herself popular with the English, she brought out all that was fine in their character. For a few hours an exalted emotion gushed forth, which the women felt even more keenly than the men, if not for so long.
"What can we do for our sister?"
was the only thought of Mesdames Callender and Leslie, as they drove through the pelting heat to inquire. Mrs. Turton was the only visitor admitted to the sick-room. She came out, ennobled by an unselfish sorrow. "She is my own darling girl," were the words she spoke, and then, remembering that she had called her Not Pucker and resented her engagement to young Heslop, she began to cry. No one had ever seen the collector's wife cry. Capable of tears, yes, but always reserving them for some adequate occasion. And now it had come. Ah, why had they not all been kinder to the stranger, more patient, given her not only hospitality but their hearts? The tender core of the heart that is so seldom used, they employed it for a little under the stimulus of remorse. If all is over, as Major Callender implied, well, all is over, and nothing can be done. But they retained some responsibility in her grievous wrong that they couldn't define. If she wasn't one of them, they ought to have made her one, and they could never do that now. She had passed beyond their invitation.
"Why don't one think more of other people?"
sighed pleasure-loving Miss Derrick. These regrets only lasted in their pure form for a few hours. Before sunset, other considerations adulterated them, and the sense of guilt, so strangely connected with our first sight of any suffering, had begun to wear away. People drove into the club with studious calm, the jog-trot of country gentlefolk between green hedgerows, for the natives must not suspect that they were agitated. They exchanged the usual drinks, but everything tasted different, and then they looked out at the palisade of cactuses stabbing the purple throat of the sky. They realized that they were thousands of miles from any scenery that they understood. The club was fuller than usual, and several parents had brought their children into the rooms reserved for adults, which gave the air of the residency at Lucknow. One young mother, a brainless but most beautiful girl, sat on a low ottoman in the smoking room with her baby in her arms. Her husband was away in the district, and she dared not return to her bungalow in case the niggers attacked. The wife of a small railway official, she was generally snubbed, but this evening, with her abundant figure and masses of corn-gold hair, she symbolized all that is worth fighting and dying for. More permanent a symbol, perhaps, than poor Adela. In a land where all else was unpunctual, the hour of the birth was chronometrically observed. 3 minutes before it was due, a Brahmin brought forth a model of the village of Gokul, the Bethlehem in that nebulous story, and placed it in front of the altar. The model was on a wooden tray about a yard square. It was of clay and was gaily blue and white with streamers and paint. Here, upon a chair too small for him and with a head too large, sat King Kansa, who is Herod, directing the murder of some innocents. And in a corner, similarly proportioned, stood the father and mother of the Lord, warned to depart in a dream. The model was not holy, but more than a decoration, for it diverted men from the actual image of the god and increased their sacred bewilderment. Some of the villagers thought the birth had occurred, saying with truth that the Lord must have been born or they could not see him. But the clock struck midnight, and simultaneously the rending note of the conch broke forth, followed by the trumpeting of elephants. All who had packets of powder threw them at the altar, and in the rosy dust and incense and clanging and shouts, infinite love took upon itself the form of Shri Krishna, and saved the world. All sorrow was annihilated, not only for Indians but for foreigners, birds, caves, railways, and the stars. All became joy, all laughter. There had never been disease nor doubt, misunderstanding, cruelty, fear. Some jumped in the air, others flung themselves prone and embraced the bare feet of the universal lover. The women behind the purdah slapped and shrieked. The little girl slipped out and danced by herself, her black pigtails flying. Not an orgy of the body, the tradition of that shrine forbade it, but the human spirit had tried by a desperate contortion to ravish the unknown, flinging down science and history and the struggle. Yes, beauty herself. Did it succeed? Books written afterwards say yes, but how, if there is such an event, can it be remembered afterwards? How can it be expressed in anything but itself? Not only from the unbeliever are mysteries hid, but the adept himself cannot retain them. He may think, if he chooses, that he has been with God, but as soon as he thinks it, it becomes history and falls under the rules of time.
"Don't worry, Mrs. Blakiston.
Those drums are only murram, the men would tell her.
Then they've started, she moaned, clasping the infant and rather wishing he would not blow bubbles down his chin at such a moment as this.
No, of course not. And anyhow, they're not coming to the club.
And they're not coming to the Burrasab's bungalow either, my dear. And that's where you and your baby'll sleep tonight, answered Mrs. Turton, towering by her side like Pallas Athene, and determining in the future not to be such a snob.
The collector clapped his hands for silence. He was much calmer than when he had flown out at Fielding. He was indeed always calmer when he addressed several people than in a tête-à-tête.
"I want to talk specially to the ladies," he said. "Not the least cause for alarm. Keep cool, keep cool. Don't go out more than you can help. Don't go into the city. Don't talk before your servants. That's all."
"Harry, is there any news from the city?" asked his wife, standing at some distance from him and also assuming her public safety voice.
The rest were silent during the august colloquy.
"Everything absolutely normal."
"I had gathered as such. Those drums are merely murram, of course."
"Merely the preparations for it. The procession is not till next week."
"Quite so. Not till Monday." "Mr. McBride's down there, disguised as a holy man," said Mrs. Callender.
"That's exactly the sort of thing that must not be said," he remarked, pointing at her. "Mrs. Callender, be more careful than that, please, in these times."
I...
She was not offended. His severity made her feel safe.
"Any more questions? Necessary questions?"
"Is the... where is he?"
Mrs. Leslie quavered.
"Jail. Bail has been refused."
Fielding spoke next. He wanted to know whether there was an official bulletin about Miss Quested's health, or whether the grave reports were due to gossip. His question produced a bad effect, partly because he had pronounced her name. She, like Aziz, was always referred to by a periphrasis.
"I hope Callender may be able to let us know how things are going before long."
"I fail to see how that last question can be termed a necessary question," said Mrs. Turton.
"Will all ladies leave the smoking room now, please?" he cried, clapping his hands again. "And remember what I have said. We look to you to help us through a difficult time, and you can help us by behaving as if everything is normal. It is all I ask. Can I rely on you?"
"Yes, indeed. Oh, indeed," they chorused out of piqued, anxious faces. They moved out, subdued yet elated, Mrs. Blakiston in their midst like a sacred flame. His simple words had reminded them that they were an outpost of empire. By the side of their compassionate love for Adela, another sentiment sprang up which was to strangle it in the long run. Its first signs were prosaic and small. Mrs. Turton made her loud, hard jokes at bridge. Mrs. Leslie began to knit a comforter.
End of Disc 5. Please continue with the next disc.
A cobra of papier-mâché now appeared on the carpet, also a wooden cradle swinging from a frame. Professor Godbole approached the latter with a red silk napkin in his arms. The napkin was God, not that it was, and the image remained in the blur of the altar. It was just a napkin, folded into a shape which indicated a baby's. The professor dandled it and gave it to the Raja, who, making a great effort, said, "I name this child Sri Krishna," and tumbled it into the cradle. Tears poured from his eyes because he had seen the Lord's salvation. He was too weak to exhibit the silk baby to his people, his privilege in former years. His attendants lifted him up, a new path was cleared through the crowd, and he was carried away to a less sacred part of the palace. There, in a room accessible to Western science by an outer staircase, his physician, Dr. Aziz, awaited him. His Hindu physician, who had accompanied him to the shrine, briefly reported his symptoms. As the ecstasy receded, the invalid grew fretful. The bumping of the steam engine that worked the dynamo disturbed him, and he asked for what reason it had been introduced into his home.
They replied that they would inquire and administered a sedative. Down in the sacred corridors, joy had seethed to jollity. It was their duty to play various